WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, While They're at War, my guest Kristen Henderson writes about what it's like for women whose husbands are in Iraq. Henderson's husband is a Navy chaplain who has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the new book, she writes about her own marriage and about the other military wives she got to know on the home front. Kristen Henderson is a frequent contributor to the Washington Post magazine. You never really wanted to or expected to be a military wife. In fact, you're a Quaker, and most of the men on your father's side of the family were conscientious objectors. Your husband was a civilian when you married him, and he later became a Navy chaplain. Does this complicate your feelings about your husband going to war?
When he first went in the military, you know, as a couple, we've always tried to support each other and support each other's dreams. And when I married him, I knew that the military had a special attraction for him. He had been Marine Corps ROTC, or Navy ROTC with a Marine Corps option in college, and then because of health issues wasn't able to complete that. So I knew that he always felt like in the Marine Corps that was sort of almost a substitute family for him and a way to feel like what he was doing was worthwhile valuable for his country, but I never expected it to actually happen. So when it did, I felt like, okay, if that's what you want to do, go for it. But I figured that was his job, not mine. And so, you know, I kind of kept that distance, and we lived off base, and I didn't really get to know a lot of other spouses initially. But, you know, September 11th really took everything I believed in and turned it on its head. I mean, before that, you know, when I felt like maybe my Quaker principles as a pacifist were being called into question when I pulled out my military ID card and let the Pentagon pay for my, medical care. And now all of a sudden, here was my husband going off to war. And, you know, when I looked at I'm from Washington, D.C., when I looked at the Pentagon that was smoking at that time and at the pictures from Manhattan, I couldn't help feeling that going to war was the right response. And so I dealt with it like a grown-up. I ran away. Well, my husband, he deployed right after September 11th and went to Afghanistan with the Marines, and I decided to take a cross-country trip, and I put my dog in the car and drove off, trying to just kind of escape all the inner turmoil I was feeling. But, somewhere along the way, I did come to some sort of inner peace or certainly to a fuller understanding of where, what the place of our military in our democratic society. By the end of the trip, I was gone about 6 weeks, and by the end of the trip, I had concluded that I was glad that there were, you know, Marines and sailors and airmen and soldiers who were willing to save us when we found ourselves in a position like this. But I was also glad there were people like the Quakers who were willing to save us from our own worst selves. I think that duality is just part of being human, and trying to walk that gray middle and make those tough choices is what the journey's about.
Now, you mentioned that you and your husband lived off base, that you really didn't know a lot of the other spouses of people in the military. When you started writing your new book, While They're at War, about the wives of soldiers, did that help connect you to military culture in a way that you hadn't actually connected to it before?
You know, it was actually before that. It was during my husband's second deployment, which was to Iraq, that I came into contact more fully with the volunteer spouse support system that was in place. And in talking to the other spouses, I found that they were often feeling the same way I did. And that was when it began to hit me how important it was to connect with other people who are going through the same experience. And in fact, I really think that's almost the only way for people who haven't been through a wartime deployment experience, to fully understand what it's like to really walk a mile in those family shoes. Because the home front experience is sort of a drip, drip, drip experience. It's a lot of little things that add up day by day. Sometimes there's a big dramatic moment, but most of the time it's these little stresses that just keep building over a long period of time.
One of the things you write about is the difficulty of the period right before a spouse deploys. And you write about irritability, that both a husband and wife can become very irritable before a deployment. And you'd think it would be the other way around, that there'd be such appreciation that spouses would have for each other before they were forced to be separated and before one of them was about to be in mortal danger. What explains that kind of irritability? And maybe you can describe how you experienced it in your own life.
Actually, that happened before a couple of deployments. And I didn't realize till later that it's very common. But you start picking fights. And subconsciously what's happening is that you're making it easier to say goodbye. So, for instance, before he left for Iraq, we had to write a letter to the landlady letting her know that I'd be moving out, and we were taking turns writing the drafts, and it just got built to this huge fight. And, finally he just sort of turned to me and said, "I'm sorry, you can go ahead and write the next draft." And that completely diffused it, and I went, I think I just want to control something. I mean, there was so little that I controlled at that point. You know, here was my husband being sent off to war again. I just wanted to control the darn letter. And at that, then we recognized what was happening, and we were able to move through it. But, you know, if you're fighting before your service member leaves, by the time they leave, you're like, good riddance, goodbye, get on the ship, get on the plane, go. And that makes saying goodbye easier. But then, of course, once they're gone, you start to feel guilty.
Another thing you write about is the awkwardness of the moment of the spouse actually leaving for deployment. Like if you go with them to the place of departure, would you describe why that's so uncomfortable in ways that you maybe didn't expect?
Yeah, I had always gone to see my husband off, and I never understood why there were so few people. His first deployment, I was one of maybe half a dozen spouses on the pier waving goodbye, and this is a ship of almost 500 people. And I couldn't understand why people didn't go. But when my husband was leaving for Iraq, the unit was all gathered at the headquarters waiting for the buses to come, and a number of family members were there, and it was getting late, it was getting close to midnight, and I overheard a young Marine say to his commanding officer, "Sir, can we send our wives home now?" And it was somehow I just suddenly realized that, I mean, he was looking for someone else to be the bad guy, you know, and send them away. And I realized that it must be so hard to have what you're leaving behind staring you in the face. I mean, it makes it even harder to go. And so a lot of folks would rather just be alone with their thoughts or with some friends or you know, a chaplain like my husband, where there's not so much at stake.
When your husband was deployed for the third time, and this was his second wartime deployment, you moved out of the house that you'd been living in with him and moved in with your sister and brother-in-law. Why didn't you want to stay in the house and live alone?
Well, again, I was fairly isolated at this assignment. His prior wartime deployment, I had known the spouses in that unit pretty well. But the unit that he deployed to Iraq with, he actually went in another chaplain's place. He got the call shortly before they deployed that this other chaplain had family health issues and would not be able to go. And so it was on pretty short notice, and I didn't know any of the spouses in that unit at all. I felt fairly isolated, and so for me, the best solution in that case was to go to my family support network rather than staying alone where I really didn't know anybody.
Were you able to keep in touch with the unit, with the wives in the unit that your husband was deployed with?
Yeah, I stayed in touch with my unit through another spouse in the unit who had volunteered to act as a liaison between the commanding officer and the families like me, and she did this by phone. And these support groups, or readiness groups as they're called in the Army, are new, actually. During the Vietnam War, there was literally no support for the families. When a soldier, when a soldier deployed, the family, if they were living with him on base, had to move off base because housing on base was for soldiers. It wasn't for families. So right at that moment where they were most in need of information and support, they were being asked to leave their community. And so after the war, the Vietnam spouses pressured the military to come up with a better system, you know, a way to get information to the families and a way to provide them with more support. And so these readiness groups are now a part of every service. And their staff, for the most part, with volunteer spouses. And I actually now act as what they call a key volunteer in the Marine Corps in this regard. And I've gone through the half a day of training where you learn all about, you know, the different services that are available. And if families have an issue, they can call me and I can tell them where they can get help. I was trying to understand why they're volunteer, because the spouses are already dealing with all the stresses and extra responsibilities of a deployment. You know, it would seem like the last thing they need is more volunteer work. But what I came to understand is that, you know, a spouse who's in trouble is just much more likely to go to a fellow spouse than to go straight to the care provider. And it's partly because in the military, if you go to a psychiatrist, a doctor, a social worker, all that becomes part of the permanent record. And, you know, you may not necessarily right off the bat want to spill your guts that way. First, you might want to talk to another spouse and kind of work your way up to that.
My guest is Kristen Henderson, author of the new book, While They're at War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kristen Henderson. Her new book is called While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front. And her husband is a Navy chaplain and has been deployed three times, twice during wartime. You know, you write that spouses of soldiers live in fear of the knock at the door. What is the procedure for letting a spouse know or for letting a family member know that a soldier has been killed?
Yeah, actually, this was a subject that I really didn't want to write about in the book. It took me a long time to work up to it. I wanted to write about the typical deployment experience, and the fact is that, you know, losing the person you love is not typical. It doesn't happen to most of us. But one thing we do all have in common is that the fear that it will. And I was talking with the chaplains on Fort Bragg, and they said when the war first began in Iraq, they started seeing this wave of grief going through the spouses who'd been left behind. So they did some research, and they started looking into, you know, what might be causing this exactly. And they found that they were seeing symptoms just like people who have a loved one with a terminal illness, and it's called anticipatory grief. And when this particular chaplain I was talking to started listing off the symptoms, it was like such an eye-opener for me, because I said, oh, you know, I had those same symptoms when my husband was in Iraq. You know, there were times I couldn't get a deep breath. I was sitting in church one time and just got this overwhelming feeling of claustrophobia and agitation, like I just wanted to get up and run out. I was crying in the shower. I was having insomnia. And essentially what I was doing was grieving as if he was already dead.
You write about one phone call that your mother got, and your mother said to you, Kristen, it's a corporal on the phone for you, and you panicked. You thought, this is the call. This is going to be the call that your husband's dead.
Yeah, it was actually a sergeant, but yeah, and that gets back to the procedure of, you know, how you're notified. And the fact is that fear, that fear that's in our minds that causes anticipatory grief, it also colors how you see everything. So, you know, my mother letting me know that I had a phone call from a sergeant, the distance from my bedroom to the phone takes me about 4 seconds to cover it. And that was enough time for me to bury my husband and then resurrect him, because I was thinking, okay, maybe he's just wounded, because they don't, you know, maybe if they call, then it's probably just because he's wounded. And here I am already killing him in 4 seconds, even though I know, as a chaplain's wife, that the death notifications are always made in person. They don't do it by phone. And sure enough, it was just a sergeant from the unit returning my phone call. And I'm not alone in this. There was a woman whose story I tell who was on the phone, and there was a knock at the door, and her young son came running, eyes wide, saying there were two soldiers at the door. And she completely freaked out, and she didn't know what to do. And her friend finally talked her into putting down the phone and going to the door. And when she opened it, it was two dog catchers, you know.
In uniform?
They had uniforms on. Yeah, mm-hmm. They had they were uniformed animal control officers. And her two dogs were running loose in the neighborhood, but she burst into tears. I mean, in that moment, her whole body had gone through that stress of, you know, what I call the tragedy that didn't happen, but it feels like it did.
Do you know the reasons why the military breaks the news the way it does, how that procedure was developed?
Yeah, it was actually begun during the Vietnam era again. early on at the Battle of Iadrang, which is covered in the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, during World War II, death notifications, all casualty notifications, were generally made by telegram. And, you know, that seems sort of cold-hearted, except everyone around you in your neighborhood had probably gotten something similar at some point, or they had someone deployed, so you had your support all around you. During Vietnam, the families were pretty isolated, and at the Battle of Iadrang, they suddenly had a lot of casualties all at once, more than their normal notification system could handle, so they started sending out these telegrams by taxi. So people were getting the news from a taxi driver. And within a couple of weeks, one of the officers' wives began pressuring the Pentagon to do a better job of notification. So that was when they began the system of sending out two or three fully uniformed officers or non-commissioned officers to deliver this kind of news in person, and then not leave the person they've notified alone until they can get family or friends there to be with them.
I interviewed one soldier who had served in Iraq who was saying that, you know, now that we have, like, cell phones and email, it's much easier when you're at war, when you're stationed in Iraq, to communicate with your spouse at home. But at the same time, it sometimes widens the gap instead of bridging the gap. And an example he gave was that, you know, one day he was speaking, I forget, it was his wife or his girlfriend, and she had spent the day or part of the day cleaning up dog poop, and he had spent part of the day cleaning up the brains of somebody who was killed. And it made him feel this widening gulf, and he found it very difficult to call home. I'm wondering how you experienced those phone calls when your husband was deployed.
You know, my husband actually didn't call very often. We relied a lot more on email. What I found with email is that there's no tone of voice, no facial expression. It's great for getting quick answers to things and for sharing what's going on in your life that day. I didn't find it, you know, I didn't find it terribly bonding. A lot of people do. They like that real immediate connection. But it's easy, I found, to get into a fight via email. You know, and sometimes the fight is who's got it worse, you know, which isn't very productive. But during my husband's deployment to Iraq, there was no telephone, no email. This was very early in the war. And so all we had were letters, and it took 2 weeks either way. So 2 weeks for a letter from me to him, and then 2 weeks back from him. And I found that I really liked the letters best. You know, maybe they weren't as helpful in getting quick answers to things. But when I was, he was traveling light. He had no paper, that kind of thing, no stationery with him. So what he would do is take the little cardboard boxes that held his meals, the meals ready to eat, MREs. And once he'd eaten a meal, he'd cut it apart, and he'd take one side of the box, and on one side it would list the nutritional data or, you know, the meal, the menu of the meal he'd eaten. And on the back side, he would, you know, lay it out like a regular postcard and write me a letter and send it to me. And I found that when I could hold that in my hands, it was something physical, and it had his very familiar, cramped handwriting on it, and I knew that he had held it. And there was something deeply comforting about holding that in my hands. And any time I missed them, being able to pick out the whole rubber-banded pack of them together and reread them, much more comforting than, you know, just light on a screen. So good old-fashioned letters were my favorite way of communicating.
You write very eloquently about what it's like when you're left alone with the memories of the person that you love while they're far away. And I'd like you to read this passage for us. It's on page 159.
When the person you love is far away for months on end, when his body is beyond your reach and you can't hold him and smell him and be reminded of his realness, when he blurs in your mind like a ghost, then each day you must dream him back to life. But each time you recreate him, you change him a little. You fill in the blank spots. Sometimes you fill in his outline with the details of his own best nature. The person he could be, his finer qualities, taking up all the space his annoying habits and human failings used to inhabit. And you fall in love all over again. Then again, sometimes you fill in his outline with the details of someone else's best nature, the person you wish he could be, a person who, unlike him, is within your reach. And in a time of war, when the rules no longer seem to apply, when young people may not grow old, and tomorrow may be worse than today, and love may not heal all wounds, you can dream yourself into a nightmare.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kristen Henderson is the author of While They're at War. She went to Iraq herself this past December, where she was embedded with the American military in Mosul. You can read her dispatches from Iraq at kristenhenderson.com. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.